tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. A gun and bomb attack on a university in northwestern Pakistan Wednesday killed at least 25 people and wounded dozens more, according to officials and hospital sources. VOA's Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad and has more details.
What we understand from the officials in Charsada, which is around 150 kilometers from Islamabad towards northwest, is that four gunmen who basically, two of them were suicide bombers. They attacked this so-called Bacha Khan University in the town of Charsada in the morning, just when the students were beginning to undertake their classes. And in fact, there was an internal annual ceremony also taking place when these four attackers entered the campus and started indiscriminately firing at students and teachers and causing so many casualties. But according to officials, there were enough security on the campus that prevented and confined these attackers to one of the blocks of the university, and that's where this six-hour-long gun battle then continued.
Again, that is VOA's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. You can read more details on that at voanews.com. Nigeria's state oil company said on Wednesday that it had shut down two of its four refineries due to crude supply problems after recent pipeline attacks. The Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation carried out an operational shutdown of the refineries in the northern city of Kaduna and Port Harcourt in the southern Niger Delta on Sunday, according to a statement. It was not clear how long the refineries would be shut. Our spokesman declined to give details. VOA News. Witnesses in the Afghan capital of Kabul say there's been a suicide car bomb attack near the Russian embassy. Pictures from the scene posted on social media show black smoke billowing into the sky. There's been no immediate reports of casualties as details of the incident are still coming in. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting Wednesday with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov in Zurich, Switzerland. It's part of a trip to Europe, the Middle East, and Asia for talks on issues that include the multinational effort to bring political stability to Syria and North Korea's recent nuclear test. The bilateral talks come at a critical time as plans to launch peace talks on a political transition in Syria on June 25th appear to be in jeopardy. Adding border checks to Europe's passport-free area could cost 3 billion euros or $3.3 billion a year in lost business. That's according to the chief executive Wednesday, seeking to reinforce a message that impulsive measures to curb migrant flows would hurt the economy. The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said, with 1.7 million workers crossing the EU internal borders every day, every hour of waiting time at the border had a cost. The International Labor Organization predicts global unemployment will worsen over the next 2 years, with emerging and developing economies bearing the brunt of the jobless market. Lisa Schlein reports.
The International Labor Organization finds more than 197 million people around the world were unemployed at the end of last year, 27 million more than the pre-crisis level of 2007. The ILO forecasts 2.3 million more people will be out of work by the end of this year, with an additional 1.1 million jobless in 2017 to reach 201.5 million unemployed. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says the slow growth of the global economy is not generating enough jobs to reverse a continuing increase in the high unemployment situation in the world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States says China must join with the rest of the world in imposing strong sanctions against North Korea over its latest nuclear test, given its special relationship with the reclusive regime. The U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken made the call on Wednesday in Seoul during a meeting with the South Korean foreign minister. Yemeni security officials say that Oman has closed its two border crossings with Yemen over fears of militant attacks, leaving Yemenis largely sealed off from the outside world. Three security officials from the eastern province of Mara, which borders Oman, told the Associated Press Wednesday that the closure took place early this year. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari says corruption has hurt the military's ability to fight the Boko Haram insurgency. The comments come as a number of former government officials face corruption-related charges. But some think there is more to Nigeria's struggles to defeat the Islamist insurgency than corruption.
That's Chris Stein reporting from Lagos. Details coming up.
Also, members of the UN Security Council arrive in Burundi tomorrow, hoping to ease political tensions and escalating violence. And Nigeria's president says corruption has hurt the military's ability to fight the Boko Haram insurgency.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Nigeria Army Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Tukur Buratai told a board of inquiry in Abuja yesterday that his troops reacted appropriately when they fired on residents of the town of Zaria in December. He said protesters were conducting an assassination attempt. An estimated 60 Shiite residents of the town died. The sect claims hundreds of its followers were killed in the clash. In other news, hundreds of villagers in the Niger Delta are evacuating homes near oil facilities in anticipation of a Nigerian military crackdown against warlord Tumpolo Ekemupolo. The AP says government authorities in Abuja claim attacks by Ekemupolo and other militants have robbed the government of more than $2.4 million daily in lost state revenues. They issued a warrant for the arrest of Ekemupolo and launched a manhunt on Friday to track down his forces. A cabinet minister warned that community leaders in the oil region of southern Nigeria will be held responsible for economic sabotage carried out by the warlord. In news from northern Nigeria, self-defense officials near the Cameroon border say a family of four died when troops from Cameroon fired a rocket at Ashigashiwa, a village near the Cameroon border, on Monday. There are unconfirmed reports that the rocket was fired indiscriminately and that Cameroon soldiers dragged off and shot two village elders. Reports of Cameroon troops looting homes and killing people and livestock along a 95-mile stretch of the border began on November 30th. Refugees from the area allege that Cameroon military have killed an estimated 150 Nigerians along the Cameroon border.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari says corruption has hurt the military's ability to fight the Boko Haram insurgency. The comments come as a number of former government officials face corruption-related charges. But some think there is more to Nigeria's struggles to defeat the Islamist insurgency than corruption. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
Information Minister Lai Mohammed says officials in former President Goodluck Jonathan's administration squandered billions of dollars meant to fight terrorism. He says money meant to help the beleaguered Nigerian army fight the Boko Haram insurgency in the country's northeast was instead spent on other things, like helping Mr. Jonathan win re-election.
It's clear that money was meant to fight terrorism. It was not used to fight terrorism.
Buhari won office in Nigeria last year on promises to fight corruption and to defeat Boko Haram. In recent months, corruption-related charges have been announced against a number of former Jonathan officials. The ex-National Security Advisor, Sambo Dasuki, is accused of awarding over $2 billion in fictitious military contracts. He denies the charges. In years past, Boko Haram militants were often able to outgun Nigeria's military. At the start of last year, the insurgents controlled territory in the northeast equal to the size of Belgium. They lost most of it to a military offensive later in the year. But Jan St. Pierre of the Berlin-based Mosakon security firm says the military's failures against the group cannot be entirely chalked up to embezzlement.
The corruption part is indeed very true. Is it as large as to make it the sort of Dasuki, the kingpin of it all, and to make it the core reason why the Nigerian army has so many problems fighting Boko Haram? I think that's exaggerated, and I think that's more of the PR aspect.
Rather, St. Pierre blamed an inflexible command that used outdated tactics against the insurgent group. Nigeria's government announced last month that it had defeated the group, but acknowledged the militants would still be able to carry out attacks on soft targets like marketplaces and bus stations. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
AP reports Zimbabwe government forces recovered 22 elephant tusks after a shootout with 11 poachers in a national park. The National Parks and Wildlife Management Authority today says the fighting occurred on Monday when Zambezi National Park rangers encountered a poacher's camp in the southern Zimbabwe park. There were no injuries and all poachers escaped. The rangers identified the poachers as Zambians because of the language they spoke. More than 60 elephants in Zimbabwe were killed by poachers last year.
European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker called a special meeting of the European Union today to discuss continued difficulties with the migrant issue. Juncker says the Commission's regular meeting is taking up the issue of how to keep the United Kingdom from leaving the EU. Lina Vidi, a spokeswoman for the UN Refugee Agency, says around 2,000 migrants continue to cross from Macedonia into Serbia daily, even with temperatures plunging to a low of 19 Fahrenheit Wednesday. Vidi says many arrive without clothing or boots appropriate for the winter weather, and that some have pneumonia, fever, or other illnesses.
A study finds that most African smallholder farmers are purchasing seeds through local informal markets, largely ignored by seed initiatives. Authors of the study say this is a problem because they bypass formal markets where new crop varieties could improve nutritional value and adapt to climate change. Instead, more than half of seed purchases are made locally from seeds saved year to year. Louise Sperling is a senior technical advisor on seed systems for the Catholic Relief Services and lead author of the report. She spoke with me about the report's findings.
Smallholder farmers need good seed and performing varieties to make agriculture productive. They need good seed for nutrition, like they need good legumes, like collard greens. They need it for climate change to help them combat climate change. And they need it for income. And the study, which is, as far as we know, the largest seed system study in the world, shows that most smallholders, and particularly in Africa, are not getting access to good seed, are not getting access to new varieties. So the plant breeding is taking place, science is taking place, but those varieties are not getting out. Farmers can't buy them.
Why is that?
At this point, very few crops, mostly maize, and very few varieties are being moved through the formal sector, through seed companies. So maybe maize, maybe some beans. So first is that what are called the farmers' channels aren't even multiplying most of the crops that farmers use. But the second big reason is that the formal channels don't go where farmers are in the middle of nowhere. They're good agro-dealer outlets, what are called shops, in towns, but not in rural areas. So what the study found, which was a bit shocking to us, and it found two things, that farmers are mostly using informal channels, meaning their own harvests or local markets or neighbors, but they're buying 51% of their seed, but they're buying it from local markets. And these local markets, which are serving farmers, often don't have the high-quality seed and the new variety. So it's a bit shocking that farmers are good customers. They're buying seed, but they can't get the kind of seed and the new varieties they really want.
Well, what needs to be done so that farmers are able to access the good seed that offers a variety of crops that are especially resistant and resilient to things such as climate change?
For climate change to help farmers tolerate it better and plan, they need a range of crops and a range of varieties to choose from. So if the rain fails, they have a short season and they have to get a short duration variety. What has to be done are several things, and all are doable. First, the seed companies themselves and the formal sector and the governments, they really have to give priority to a larger number of crops for climate change, cereals, legumes particularly can be important. For nutrition, the legumes are very important. That means beans and peanuts and cowpea, things like that. But second, we have to reconsider how we deliver seed to farmers, how we make it on offer. We have to set up a new science of delivery. Take seed to the last mile. There is some good work showing that you can license mom-and-pop stores. So these stores that sell sugar and tea, oil, they can also sell seed. So sell where farmers actually buy. A third big change for seed and the seed industry is that we have to consider our customer as the smallholder farmer. Focus on the smallholder. Right now, the big buyer are institutions, NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or the UN, who buy seed and then give it free. But if we focus on the smallholder, millions of farmers will buy. They don't need to get it free. And one of the things we found is very effective is to pack in very small sizes. So make seed affordable.
So then how will farmers access these new varieties?
Well, the good news is that many of these new varieties exist, varieties that serve farmers' needs. So science of plant breeding in the last decade has developed some very good varieties to help with climate change like drought, to help with nutrition, so they're biofortified. So now we need to turn to a science of delivery, which is equally important. We need to seriously say, how are we going to make available and accessible these new varieties at the last mile to the farmer in the middle of nowhere? So let's now move to a science of delivery.
That was Louise Sperling, Senior Technical Advisor on Seed Systems for the Catholic Relief Services and lead author of the report. She spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Members of the UN Security Council arrive in Burundi tomorrow, hoping to ease political tensions and escalating violence. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari says corruption has hurt the military's ability to fight the Boko Haram insurgency. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Members of the UN Security Council arrive in Burundi tomorrow, hoping to ease political tensions and escalating violence. It's the Council's second visit to Burundi in 9 months. The U.S., France, and Angola are leading the 15-member delegation that will spend 2 days in the country. Hundreds have died and many thousands have been displaced since April after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. Last week, UN Human Rights Chief Zaid Ra'ad Al Hussein described what he called gang rapes of women by Burundi security forces, as well as torture and ethnic repression. He said all the alarm signals are flashing red, including the increasing ethnic dimension of the crisis. In related news, U.S. State Department spokesperson Mark Toner says the United States is alarmed by the reports of the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, including eyewitness reports of mass graves. Today, the Burundi government has planned to respond to the allegations today, but then canceled a news conference. Reporter Moses Habayarimana is following developments in Bujumbura. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the current security situation and other issues.
Currently, we have seen a relatively calm Bujumbura for the last 2 weeks, but it was only last night when we had some shootings in some areas in the suburbs of the Bujumbura But according to the police spokesman, early in the morning, he said that no casualties, but 5 grenades exploded in one of the areas where protests against President Pierre Nkurunziza were happening. That is in Musaga. There's a beefed up security, especially in Bujumbura, with a lot of roadblocks and checkpoints in order to secure the capital ahead of the UN Security Council members who will be visiting the country tomorrow.
What is expected from the UN Security Council member meeting?
We understand that the UN Security Council is possibly going to push the Burundi government for an inclusive dialogue with the opposition in order to defuse the current political crisis which has occupied the country since last April. The dialogue, which was relaunched in Entebbe, the Burundi government have pointed out some issues which had concerns about the participants who represented the opposition parties and also the civil society organizations, where they're not happy with it, and they said they cannot dialogue or talk to the coup plotters, whom they say they are coup plotters. Yesterday, also the relaunching of the Inter-Burundi Dialogue as well, the new commission which was set up by the president himself to conduct the dialogue countrywide. The relaunching was yesterday. It took place in Kirundo, one of the provinces in the countryside, and they expect it to go on. The question remains on whether the Burundi government will also join the dialogue talks out of the country that it was expected to be under-mediated by the Ugandan president in Arusha.
Who exactly is taking part in the inter-Burundi dialogue?
Burundi government have said that all of the Burundians will be taking part in this dialogue, most especially the opposition, the civil society organization, the Burundians themselves, the citizens will be taking part in this. But however, there is a concern about the opposition who are outside the country. They raised the concern and they said that they couldn't trust the dialogue commission. They said that they more trust the mediation under Museveni, where it's expected to be conducted in Arusha, which is about the inclusiveness of the dialogue. However, the dialogue commission also said that they will be available to travel outside the country to meet the stakeholders. But the question remains if the Burundi government will be able to dialogue with the opposition and the civil society organization, which it alleges of plotting the coup, and said that it won't go on the same table with them. And actually, these are the current stakeholders of the crisis currently, which is rocking the country.
Now, as you know, the UN human rights chief leveled some very serious allegations last week, including gang rape allegations against Burundi security forces. Did the government respond to those allegations?
We expected the Minister of Social Justice and Gender to have a press conference later on today, but unfortunately, he postponed the press conference due to some ongoing Council of Ministers meeting, which is taking place in Bujumbura. So we are still yet to get some comments from the government about the allegation and the report.
That's reporter Moses Habayarimana from Bujumbura. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
In related news, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Powell, commented on the Security Council visit to Burundi. Speaking with VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir, Ambassador Powell spoke about the message that will be delivered to the government.
The Security Council is leaving for Burundi. Can you tell us a bit about what your message is going to be to President Nkurunziza and to the opposition?
Well, the main message is this is a critical crossroads for Burundi. 230,000 people have already been displaced. 400 people have already been killed. They cannot let it become business as usual, that you wake up in the morning and there's a corpse on the street as you try to get to work. And that is what is starting to happen in Burundi. So we will come in and throw our weight behind accelerated mediation of the kind that should have taken place over these many months, over the enhanced deployment of a UN presence. You know that the UN presence has been getting smaller as the crisis has been getting bigger. That's the wrong trajectory. And then finally, on behalf of the African Union proposed deployment, the Security Council will come in and urge the government of Burundi to engage in a more constructive posture on behalf of that force, which has been proposed, but the contours of which have not been worked through.
So then, is the United States' position that the AU force should deploy? Because we know President Nkurunziza has been firmly opposed to it.
He has been very adamant about that publicly, but I think a lot of African leaders have weighed in since the initial rejections of the force. And, you know, what we will seek to do, the United States, but I think also the full council, is appeal to him to think about the stability of the country. And instead of rejecting out of hand what the African Union has put forward, to actually think about what contours for a force would make sense How could a force like that become a friend to stability rather than something that he sees as threatening Burundian sovereignty? Things have gotten a lot worse just even in the last few weeks in terms of the economic situation as well as in terms of killings. And so our main message to him is going to be, you know, at what point are you going to start to accept the appeals of the international community? At what point are you going to listen to what people who really only have the best interests of the Burundian people at heart are saying to you, for the sake of your country, please open yourself up to mediation, to a UN presence, and to an international force. This is going to be in the best interest of the Burundian people.
And when you say a UN presence, do you mean a political presence? Can you describe a little bit about what kind of UN role you foresee, or the United States foresees?
Yeah, well, we've come from a situation where they had an election monitoring mission, and that has now been closed down. In fact, one of the things that we will not get to see is a UN mission. The last time we were there as a council, we actually had all of our meetings on a UN base, and that's not going to happen this time because much of the mission has been liquidated. So I think there's a lot of flexibility between getting to zero, which is the UN's current plan, and building it out where it's a sizable presence that can have eyes and ears on the ground. And I think that has to be worked through. But the main thing right now is a political presence where Jamal Benamar and his team can be there to, you know, inform the council, to inform the international community what's going on, to come up with best thoughts on which tools in the toolbox can be employed in order to support the mediation and the international presence.
And would that include more human rights monitors?
It should. The African Union, as you know, authorized a very long time ago human rights observers to be sent to Burundi, and very few of them have deployed. So that will be another part of our message on the part of the council, is to say eyes and ears can be a deterrent. Just the mere presence can actually serve to protect civilians. But also they can, if you think that the international community is getting one half of the story, then what are you afraid of? You know, let these observers in, let them see what's happening. The opposition, some of the opposition has become armed and are part of an insurgency now. The United States has sanctioned individuals who are part of that insurgency. But it's in everyone's interest to get as an objective accounting as of what's happening on the ground as possible.
That was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power. She spoke with VOA correspondent Margaret Bashir. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Zuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more. Coming up next, right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. Peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed, with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews, analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Members of the UN Security Council arrive in Burundi tomorrow, hoping to ease political tensions and escalating violence. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari says corruption has hurt the military's ability to fight the Boko Haram insurgency. Coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia and later a call for more targeted standards in developing countries to help in the treatment of liver cancer. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a Filipino boxing star tops your sports report.
Kim, let's begin with boxing's Pac-Man.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Filipino star Manny Pacquiao says his fight on April 9th against American Timothy Bradley, the third bout between the two men, will be his goodbye to boxing.
I'm so happy hanging my gloves after this fight because of what I have done. You know, I will feel sad after that, but, you know, that's life. Not all the time you're keep on fighting. Not in the time, all the time is you're in the ring, but it's time, I think.
The 37-year-old Pacquiao has won world titles in 8 different weight divisions. He spoke in Los Angeles, California, where he and Bradley began promoting their fight. Bradley won their first encounter in 2012 by a controversial 12-round split decision. Pacquiao dominated their rematch in 2014, winning a 12-round unanimous decision. Bradley says he's confident of winning their third fight.
Knowing what I know, being 24 rounds with him, knowing Manny Pacquiao, he's not King Kong. I feel that, honestly, that this is my time. I'm going to win this fight April 9th.
Meanwhile, our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moweta, is putting his money on Bradley to win.
Well, in the fight game, Sonny, this is what we call a rubber match. The first fight, Timothy Bradley won by controversial split decision. That was in 2012. In 2014, Pacman won unanimous decision. So now we're going into April 9th at the MGM Grand Casino. The boxing world, everybody said, oh, this is a terrible fight. Why do we want to see this? We know who won the last two. Why do we have to go to the third fight? But don't forget, Timothy Bradley has a new trainer in Teddy Atlas. And in November of last year, he destroyed Brandon Reyes. So it depends on what Manny Pacquiao will do. Mind you, he's coming back from shoulder injury. And he will start training right here in Hollywood in the month of February. And when you come back and do the Hollywood shuffle with all these celebrities, your mind will not be on the fight because you think it's going to be an easy fight. I see the first big upset of the year when he takes on Bradley April 9th. If he comes here and do the Hollywood thing with a bad shoulder, I don't see him able to get up for it. He's 37 years old now, Sonny. And he believes it's an easy fight. All the fans believe it's an easy fight. Why do we have to put up with this terrible fight? He's beating Timothy Bradley twice. Why do we have to pay for it? We're not going to pay for it. We don't care about this fight. We don't want to see this fight. But I'm telling you now, Sonny, this may be the first upset of 2016. I'll put my money on Bradley.
Take it to the bank, VOA boxing fans. Nnamdi Hollywood Moweta is putting his money on Timothy Bradley to beat Manny Pacquiao April 9th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Host Rwanda beat Gabon Wednesday 2-1 in the capital, Kigali, to book a place in the quarterfinals at the African Nations Championship football tournament, also called CHAN. 24-year-old striker Ernest Segura, who's based in the capital with the club AS Kigali, was the man of the match for the Wasps of Rwanda. Ernest found the net shortly before halftime, and he bagged another goal a few moments after the break. Aaron Boupenza pulled one back for Gabon in the 53rd minute. The Gabonese played most of the second half with 10 men after Tchen Kabi was sent off for a second yellow card. The victory gives Rwanda the maximum 6 points in Group A after they beat Ivory Coast 1-0 in the opening match of the tournament January 16th. Morocco is playing Ivory Coast in Wednesday's second match. In Tuesday's Group D matches, played in Gisenyi, Rwanda, Zambia edged neighbor Zimbabwe 1-0, and Mali and Uganda played to a 2-2 draw. Meanwhile, with this Chan tournament now in its fifth day of competition, our African football guru David Legg is giving Rwandan officials high marks for organization.
Yeah, I'm proud to say, Sonny, that our predictions of the Sunnyside Sport of a week ago have certainly come true. We said that this was going to be a well-organized, well-attended tournament, and that's exactly what's happened. There was not a spare space in the Amahoro Stadium for the opening doubleheader. That's a 30,000-capacity stadium. And the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, who I think has taken a very personal hand in the organization of this tournament, he will have been very pleased. I have seldom heard such cheering for a head of state when he came down from the stand to meet the Rwandan and Ivorian players. A very warm welcome indeed. For a man who's really turned that country around, very sad background to Rwanda. Back in 1994, a genocide, hundreds of thousands of people killed. And it's quite clear to me that the wounds are being slowly but surely healed. This is a country with a high domestic growth, and it looks to me that, Sonny, whereas a lot of people in Africa do a lot of talking, in Rwanda, the key word is action. They just get on with the job. On to Butare on Sunday, this university city in the south of the country, a 10,000-capacity stadium, and it was packed. A lot of the spectators came from the Democratic Republic of Congo, from Goma in particular. And according to reports, it's about a four-hour drive. And it shows you the interest in this CHAN tournament that literally thousands of Congolese were prepared to make that journey into Rwanda to watch their team play. On to Monday, Sunny, the Stade du Kigali. Again, the same story, a very healthy attendance. A lot of Rwandans turning up. And looking at the faces of these spectators, they're enjoying themselves and they're having a ball. The atmosphere is very pleasant. There's no aggression whatsoever. So far, Sonny, it's a big thumbs up for Rwanda. They're doing a superb job. And the stakes are high because I believe if they do succeed with the organization of this CHAN competition, that the Africa Cup of Nations, the big one, the showpiece of African football, will beckon. Now, it's going to be some time in the future because Gabon will hold the 2017 Cup of Nations, Cameroon 2019, Ivory Coast 221, and even Guinea, they're slotted in for 223. So the next available Cup of Nations is 225. East Africa has not hosted a Cup of Nations since 1976, when Ethiopia hosted what was then an eight-nation tournament. So East Africa are long overdue. Now, Rwanda have successfully held the African Under-17 Championship, the African Under-20 Championship. I think they're well on their way to successfully hosting the CHAN. So come 2025, if Rwanda are interested, and I believe they will be, don't be surprised, Sonny. It's a very long-range forecast if Rwanda become the Africa Cup of Nations hosts of that year. They're doing a superb job so far.
David, you're doing a superb job so far with your African football quizzes. Can you give us your latest one?
Yes, certainly, Sonny. Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League? And that includes the former name of the competition. It was then known as the African Cup of Champions Clubs. So what we're talking about, Sonny, is way back to 1964 when this competition started. So it's between 1964 and 2015. Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League?
2016 is a leap year, David, so we're going to set a deadline of Monday, February 29th, to get your entries in. David and I will now tell you where you can send your entries.
VOA!
It's david.legge, and legge is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legge, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. So get your entries in by February 29th to David Legge's latest African football quiz. The first three people with correct answers will receive some of those delightful VOA goodies. On Thursday, the action at the 4th African Nations Championship football tournament will take place in Butare in Rwanda's southern province, and we'll have two matches in Group B. In the first game, Angola will go against the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that will be followed by a match between Cameroon and Ethiopia. The DR Congo and Cameroon top the group with 3 points each, although the Congolese are in first place based on goal difference. In the opening group matches Sunday, the DRC defeated Ethiopia 3-0, while Cameroon beat Angola 1-0. In National Basketball Association news, center Joakim Noah of the Chicago Bulls will be sidelined between 4 to 6 months after undergoing shoulder surgery. Noah is one of the NBA's top defenders. In fact, he was named the league's Defensive Player of the Year in 2014. The surgery repaired a dislocated left shoulder. Joakim Noah, by the way, is the son of the former French tennis great Yannick Noah. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. Send me your tweets. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a call for more targeted standards in developing countries to help in the treatment of liver cancer. And next, political and economic problems back home is putting a burden on Zimbabweans working outside the country. But first, some music. Here is Teddy Afro from Ethiopia with Salami. We'll be right back. Eddie Afro from Ethiopia with Seleme.
Well, experts are calling for more targeted standards in developing countries to help diagnose and treat risk factors for liver cancer. It is currently the second most deadly form of cancer worldwide. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Liver cancer accounts for some 750,000 deaths a year globally. Experts say only pancreatic cancer accounts for more deaths. In Western countries, liver cancer typically strikes middle-aged men over 60 who drink alcohol and smoke cigarettes. But the patient profile is a bit different in developing countries, including sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and China. There, it's not uncommon to see liver cancer in young people.
It could be 4 or 5 decades earlier. So, in fact, you are losing your entire life when you are in such major trouble.
Pascal Pinault, a cancer geneticist at Pasteur Institute in Paris, says more than 86% of liver cancer deaths occur in the developing world. But standards to diagnose and treat the disease follow guidelines based on the older Western patients. The guidelines help doctors determine the best course of treatment. Pinault was part of a team of French and Peruvian researchers who conducted a study in the Latin American country involving 250 liver cancer patients who underwent surgery. Their average age was 36, and relatively few had cirrhosis or hardening of liver tissue, which is common in Western liver cancer patients. Under the treatment guidelines, Pinault says those patients might have been written off as incurable, despite their young age and the lack of cirrhosis. They would not have been given potentially life-extending treatment, including surgery, for the lethal disease. Pinault says most patients in developing countries get the most common form of liver cancer after being infected with hepatitis B for a long period of time.
You are living in sub-Saharan Africa, you are infected by hepatitis B virus, but you are also eating food contaminated with a toxin from microscopic fungi, and then you will develop the liver cancer.
He says many liver cancers worldwide could be avoided through hepatitis B vaccination, but there's a hitch. The vaccine endorsed by the World Health Organization is a series of 4 injections that Pinault says is not easy to get for many people living in remote areas.
I suspect that in some occasion, the vaccination is not done. The immunization is not done.
In addition to increasing the number of people who get vaccinated against hepatitis B, writing in the journal Helion, Pinault and colleagues call for changing the treatment guidelines to help young liver cancer patients who, for now, might be considered incurable. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabweans living in the diaspora say events unfolding in their home country is affecting them as much as their relatives and friends living there. Chairman Solomon Socks Chikowero is with the Global Zimbabwe Forum in Johannesburg, South Africa. He says political and economic problems back home are putting a burden on Zimbabweans working outside the country. Chikowero tells reporter Jonga Kandimeri that Zimbabweans in the diaspora have the obligation to change things through engaging with the government and fully participating in activities that help build the nation.
In every situation, social issues, economical issues, and political issues go hand in hand. So you cannot separate them from one another. So the issues that are happening home, whether it be political or economic or social, they are affecting us as the diaspora because we are the ones who are funding the economy of Zimbabwe, the bigger chance of money going into Zimbabwe and the remittances is coming from the diaspora. The diaspora is the one who is feeding their families in Zimbabwe, and even the extended families that are being fed from the diaspora. So now that is becoming too heavy on us when there are so much disturbances in the country, both politically, socially, and economically, because it also affects us. It puts us at an easy position. So the things that happen at home, yes, they really affect us.
How best can this be addressed?
I think time has come now for the government to realize that it cannot continue running away from its shadow. We are the shadow of the government, and the government is our master, regardless of whether I'm a member of the governing party or not. But we as Zimbabweans, we are being governed by that government. So whether it takes us to be state enemies, but when we are in diaspora like this, it's time that we start working together. And the starting point to work together is one to make sure that we are recognized as Zimbabweans by dual citizenship. Two, we must be allowed to do a diaspora vote. We must be allowed to be voting from wherever we are so that we participate fully in the economy of the country, in the political issues of the country, even in the social. So how do we do that? If the government can accept that we are Zimbabweans, we can contribute to Zimbabwe not only economically, but also politically and socially, then they must start negotiations, they must start dialogues with the diaspora so that we work together, so that by the next coming general election, people are allowed to vote from wherever they are. Most countries are doing it. So what's so special with Zimbabwe? What's the exception of Zimbabwe? It can also do it. So it can, and that is going to be for the benefit of Zimbabweans at large. Not individuals, not individual organizations, not individual people, but Zimbabweans at large.
But what are you doing as Zimbabweans in the diaspora to try and address this issue?
Discussions are always there. We have always been doing meetings. If you look, for example, during the Government of National Unity, the GNU, we had some ministers who were coming from Zimbabwe to come and attend to these issues I'm talking about. We had the likes of Paul Mangwana and the likes of Douglas Monzora who were coming to South Africa so that we discuss these issues, and they have them. It's not that they don't have them. They have got our proposals, they've got our notes, they've got everything with them. What is remaining is for them to wake up from their sleep and say, but no, these guys from diaspora, these are their proposals. Because I remember very well the other meeting we did, we had even people from the UK in the diaspora to come and meet these guys in South Africa from the GNU. When we were talking about the issue of dual citizenship, the issue of diaspora vote, and so many other issues. So the dialogue has been there, and we are still pushing as and when meetings are called for, and as and when we need to push them so that they keep reminded. So we always remind them. Whenever we are given the platform to do it. And if you look at it also goes with the types of ambassadors who are in whatever country. If the ambassador has got an open door policy, we go there and present to them.
That was Chairman Solomon Chikawero of the Global Zimbabwe Forum speaking with reporter Jonga Kandamira from Johannesburg, South Africa. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Libya, the four-year political power struggle following the fall of Muammar Gaddafi's regime split and destabilized the country. On December 17th, UN-facilitated political envoys from Libya's two rival governments and a number of independent political figures signed the Libyan political agreement that will form a unified Libyan government of national accord. Subsequently, the UN Security Council on December 23rd unanimously passed on UN Security Council Resolution 2259, welcoming the formation of the new government of national accord and sending a clear message that this unified government will be the sole legitimate government of Libya. The Presidency Council that will lead the new government is currently working actively towards the formation of the new government with the support of the United Nations. To address Libya's threat from ISIL and other terrorist groups, Libya needs a united government. In the past weeks, ISIL-affiliated militants have conducted a number of violent attacks in Libya. In the first week of January, they attempted to capture the Sidra oil port and the nearby oil town of Ras Lanuf, and in the process set fire on a number of oil tanks. On January 7th, a suicide bomber drove a truck into a training camp for Coast Guard cadets. At least 65 people were killed. The United States strongly condemns these attacks and extends its condolences to the families of the victims. Violent extremists, including ISIL-affiliated groups, threaten all Libyans throughout the country. With their attacks on oil fields, they are threatening resources that belong to the Libyan people and that all Libyans must strive to protect for future generations, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby. These incidents stress again the urgent need for Libya's new leaders to formalize the government of national accord, as outlined in the Libyan political agreement. This is a vital step to address the country's critical humanitarian, economic, and security challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, peace talks between the Burundian government and the opposition groups have been postponed with no word on when they may resume. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the crisis in Burundi. That's next time on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.